Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 9th. Any day now, President Biden is expected to announce his nominee for the Supreme Court to succeed Justice Breyer when he retires at the end of this term. The president has made clear he will nominate the court's first black woman. Once upon a time, President Ronald Reagan placed the first woman of any background on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. She's retired now and still alive at 91. Reagan, in his lifetime, certainly expressed his pride at having a hand in that milestone. In fact, in his campaign for the presidency in 1980, he made as explicit a pledge as Biden has now. Reagan said this.
During my campaign for the presidency, I made a commitment that one of my first appointments to the Supreme Court vacancy would be the most qualified woman that I could possibly find. Now, this is not to say that I would appoint a woman merely to do so. That would not be fair to women, nor to future generations of all Americans whose lives are so deeply affected by decisions of the court. Rather, I pledge to appoint a woman who meets the very high standards that I demand of all court appointees. I have identified such a person.
So that was the moment that he nominated Sandra Day O'Connor. So listeners, would you call these nominations examples of affirmative action? As it happens, the Supreme Court has also recently announced that it will hear a new challenge to its own precedents on affirmative action in college admissions in lawsuits against Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Interesting and important confluence of events, right? Biden's stated intention and these lawsuits coming right now. Georgetown University law professor Paul Butler is also a contributing columnist to the Washington Post, and he has a column basically called, I once told a Supreme Court justice that I was a recipient of affirmative action. We'll invite him to tell that story here now and also invite your stories of being recipients of affirmative action as we discuss the legal and racial justice arguments pro and con. Justice Clarence Thomas, for example, as some of you know, says he was alienated from affirmative action by his experience with it. Call us with your own affirmative action experiences at 212-433-WNYC. Professor Paul Butler is also author of the book, Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, it's always good to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be here.
Want to just start with a story in your article? The justice was Sandra Day O'Connor, right?
And it was May 2003. That June, the Supreme Court was expected to decide a case about whether affirmative action in college admissions was constitutional. If the court decided that it was unconstitutional, then the number of African Americans and Latinx people and Native Americans would dramatically drop. Justice O'Connor was going to be the deciding vote, everybody knew. Brian, she was the graduation speaker at George Washington University Law School, where I was a professor.
Uh-huh.
And the students had voted me professor of the year, which meant that I got to make a little speech.
Huh.
Oh, man, what should I do? What should I say? Some of my colleagues thought it would be tacky, inappropriate if I mentioned the case at all. Some of my other colleagues thought, you got to go for it, Paul. This is the one opportunity that you have. This is what I did. I got up. I thanked the students for voting me professor of the year. And I said that my success had been accomplished because of my mother's love, because of my hard work, and because of affirmative action. And that was it. The Associated Press reported later that Justice O'Connor sat quietly, her hands folded in her lap, while students and some faculty members applauded.
And the AP said that it was an awkward moment. You note that you did not tell O'Connor in your remarks that you thought she too was a beneficiary of affirmative action. But did you consider doing that in your remarks? And would you put that description on her appointment as we just heard it described by Ronald Reagan?
She did. In a later conversation with then Chief Justice Rehnquist about affirmative action, Justice O'Connor said, well, you know, I'm on the court because of it. So I don't think when people like us benefit from it, when we're invited to spaces where we were never invited before, as you heard President Reagan acknowledge, that we're stigmatized by it. We're not ashamed by it. We're proud to be present, and we understand the difference that our presence makes in these institutions. And so I didn't have to tell Justice O'Connor that. It might have been an announcement to the rest of the world, or especially to people who aren't familiar with how affirmative action works. So I didn't have time to make a constitutional argument. I didn't have time to make a policy argument. I wanted to do what critical race theorists call using the body as evidence. Hmm. Brian, I wanted my black body to be a data point. The fact that the students had voted me a recipient of affirmative action, the reason that I got into Yale College and Harvard Law School was because of affirmative action. And to anybody who might have dared think that I wasn't qualified, well, here I was, voted by the graduating class of a fine law school, professor of the year.
And then Sandra Day O'Connor became the swing vote in the important affirmative action case that year. Remind everyone which one that was and how that went.
It was a case called Grutter. It came from the University of Michigan, where a white student challenged their affirmative action program, saying that she was being discriminated against because she was white. Justice O'Connor cast the deciding vote. Parentheses, I had nothing to do with that, I sincerely believe. And she saved affirmative action. She saved diversity in higher education. She made it possible for the black middle class to continue to exist and to prosper, and for African-American and Latinx people and Native Americans and some groups of Asian Americans to be admitted to the hollow halls of elite schools, where we have prospered. We have demonstrated time and time again that we belong, and that all happened because of one vote by one woman, the first woman on the Supreme Court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
There are so many follow-up questions just to that little incident that I want to ask you. We'll get into the Ronald Reagan clip we just heard and how it relates to what Biden is intending with his Supreme Court appointment forthcoming. But you just said a very, if I heard you right, you made a pretty sweeping statement there that without affirmative action, we wouldn't have the black middle class. How far do you go with that?
The black middle class consists of people who work for the government, people who are lawyers and doctors and professionals. These are folks who have college educations and often graduate school educations. And the reality is that before affirmative action, African Americans were not present at selective institutions in large numbers. There was a study done by the presidents of Yale, Harvard, and Princeton about affirmative action after it had been around for a while to see how it worked. What's the evidence? The evidence was that people who got admitted to those schools through affirmative action did not only as well, but better in some cases than other people, including white folks. And what affirmative action means in college is that when folks apply to selective institutions, often way more qualified people apply than can be admitted. And qualified means you can do the work, you can get A's, you'll do well, you'll graduate. And there has to be some way of choosing among all these qualified people. And everybody understands that legacy admissions are a big deal. If your parents and grandparents went to the school, you get a break, you get a leg up. Also, if you're an athlete, if you play a sport, if you're applying to Harvard or Yale and you're from Alaska or North Dakota, a place where they don't get a lot of students, you get a break. Affirmative action means that if you're a member of an underrepresented minority, especially an African American, a Latinx person, a Native American, and some groups of Asian Americans, then that counts as a plus. It counts as a plus because for a long time, your folks got left out. Your folks couldn't join the party. And it counts as a plus because our presence in those classrooms helps everybody learn better.
Although, do I understand previous Supreme Court decisions correctly as saying colleges and universities may not engage in affirmative action for the reason you just stated, that is because of past discrimination, to make up for past discrimination in any way? They can use affirmative action if they see an educational purpose to it, like that having a diverse student body is an inherent good for all the students, but they cannot use it as a way to make up for past discrimination against blacks or other groups. Do I have that wrong?
You have it right, Brian. So think of three arguments in favor of affirmative action, three theories about why it should exist. One is to make up for past discrimination. It's kind of like a tort remedy in the law. It's to put people of color in the place where we would be, but for centuries of white supremacy and near genocidal policies. The second theory is it's kind of like a super anti-discrimination remedy. The idea there is that a lot of folks don't want us in institutions, in spaces that used to be all white. And it's not enough to say you can't discriminate unless you make those groups have some kind of incentive to include folks of color. They won't do it. And the third rationale is diversity, that there's something about having American institutions look like America that's important and good. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Bakke, decided back in the 70s, said that only that third rationale, diversity, was constitutional for using race in higher education as a consideration. And in the Grutter case, decided in 2003, Justice O'Connor for the court endorsed that rationale.
So Justice Thomas sees its role in his life differently, as you obviously know. One of his quotes is, "Every time the government places citizens on racial registers and makes race relevant to the provision of burdens or benefits, it demeans us all, demeans us all." And a New Yorker profile of him a few years ago said, according to Thomas, affirmative action is the most recent attempt by white people to brand and belittle black people as inferior. Affirmative action does not formally mirror the tools of white supremacy. In other words, they're saying he doesn't think it merely mirrors the tools of white supremacy. For Thomas, the article says, it is the literal continuation of white supremacy. And the article places him in the context of, this is why I said sort of critical race theory, disagree if you want, but that Clarence Thomas apparently sees a permanence, a persistence, a permanence of white racism in America and judges on the basis of that. Do you understand where he's coming from, even if you disagree?
I kind of sort of do, but that's kind of like asking, do I understand the premise of anti-blackness? I get it, but it's wrong. So Justice Thomas apparently felt stigmatized by affirmative action. He, I guess, was hyper aware hyper-interested in what white folks thought about him, and apparently white folks communicated to him that either he wasn't qualified to be there, or that the fact that race played a role in why he was there diminished his value. That's not how most recipients of affirmative action understand their experience. Without affirmative action, the reality is they're not black and brown people in the classroom. Think about the stigma that that communicates, that there's something about African Americans and Latinx people that they don't belong at Yale and Harvard and University of Chicago with us white folks. So I think the expressive value of having no or few black and brown people in the classroom, that's a way greater stigma than a few random white boys thinking that their other white boy would have got into the school but for affirmative action.
Wilson in Bushwick, you're on WNYC with Professor Paul Butler. Hi, Wilson.
Hi, hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call, and I think this is a very interesting conversation, so I'm going to go ahead and call in. So I am an African-American male, and I went to an elite college as well. I went to Vanderbilt University, and one of the things that I would hear, specifically my freshman year, was that, oh, well, you know, I must have gotten in because of affirmative action or quotas, where it's like, you know, I graduated third in my class in high school. Our valedictorian went to Harvard. You know, the salutatorian went to, you know, got into Yale, but I'm from Tennessee originally, so he stayed in Tennessee as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, like, when we think about, like, how affirmative action works, right? And I'm not pushing back against the professor who, like, I think that affirmative action is necessary because it does get women, white women as well, and people of color into spaces that they may not have been into, but also like this assumption that, you know, well, we're there because of this. And it's not the case. Like, we are there because we're good, you know? And so what I'm curious about is the nuance of this language, you know, and the way that the narrative is told that, you know, affirmative action harms everyone, you know, except white men. And I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Professor.
I'm sorry. Do you mean that the narrative is that affirmative action helps everyone except white men?
That's the narrative. Yes, that's the narrative that's told, that it helps everyone except white men. But what's not being shared is that, like, you know, when you add diversity, you know, to any type of space, where it's a workspace or a school space or an educational space, it actually does help everyone.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Professor Butler?
So I'll answer by wishing Wilson and Brian a happy Black History Month. Black History Month was articulated by a man named Carter G. Woodson. Woodson was the second black person to get a PhD from Harvard University. W.E.B. Du Bois was the first. So Wilson, they didn't need affirmative action. Harvard didn't have it back then. They had to fight a lot harder to get in because they were black. And the reality is that even if affirmative action goes away, they're going to be people like Carter G. Woodson and W.E.B. Du Bois who get in. But that's not most black folks. Here's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's not most white folks either, including most white people. I taught at Harvard Law School. I went to Yale College. I've had some amazing white students, but they're no more amazing than the black and brown folks who got in through affirmative action. Wilson said, well, how do you know? that they got in through affirmative action. So we'll learn a lot about the process in these upcoming Supreme Court cases. But if you focus too much on numbers, if you just look at SAT, ACT, and GPA, then you're going to have a whole lot more white folks in the front. And the problem is that those numbers don't mean all that much. There's a minimum, but above the minimum, there are a lot of black people, a lot of brown people who can do the work, who can get A's, who can graduate at the top of their class. So what affirmative action means is don't only look at the numbers. Don't give them too much weight. Think about people's life experiences. Brian, I'm teaching stop and frisk in my criminal law class in a couple of weeks. If I didn't have black students and black male students in that room to talk about what it's like, it'd be a whole different education.
It would all be book learning. Last question. There's been so much discussion about how the Supreme Court might discard its own precedent in Roe versus Wade and throw that one out. Would it have to discard its own precedent in the Grutter case we've been talking about from 2003 in order to throw out affirmative action in these new cases?
Indeed it would. But what we've seen from this radical right-wing Supreme Court is that it's cool with that. It's all good to return the United States to what it was like back in the day when straight white men ruled. That's the agenda of the Supreme Court. And they got 6-3 votes to accomplish that goal.
And I guess, judging from your article, you think there isn't as much open-mindedness on the Republican appointees' parts as there was by Sandra Day O'Connor.
They're not justices like her. Justice Kennedy, the conservative Republican-appointed judge who ushered in marriage equality. Justice Souter, another Republican-appointed judge. Now we have right-wing firebrands. This is the moment that Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito have been waiting for 20 or 30 years. That moment is now here. God help America.
Paul Butler teaches law at Georgetown. He's a former federal prosecutor, an MSNBC contributor, and a Washington Post contributing columnist. His latest is, "I once told a Supreme Court justice that affirmative action got me into Harvard and Yale. Today, they wouldn't listen." Always great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.